This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book business. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Frank Rose. He's an author and has most recently published a book called The Art of Immersion, How the Digital Generation is Remaking Hollywood, Madison Avenue, and the Way We Tell Stories. And we might want to talk about that because I think that's really apropos of what Publishing Talks is about. But we'll also talk about a book that he has recently republished, called the The West of Eden, which is the end of innocence at Apple Computer. So hi Frank, how are you?
Hi, very good, David. How are you?
Good. I'm really glad that you had some time to talk today. Maybe the best thing to do to start is for you to talk a little bit about your history as a writer and, you know, kind of the things you're interested in and you've written about, so people who are listening have a sense of what you're about.
Sure. I've been a writer at Wired for the past 10 or 12 years. And before that, I have written for Fortune and Esquire and in the early 90s, Premier Magazine, which was one of the most interesting publications to cover Hollywood. And I really started out in the 70s writing for The Voice right out of college about the music scene, and in particular the CBGB scene, which I was sort of lucky enough to stumble across shortly after I arrived in New York. And from there I went on to Rolling Stone and eventually, as I mentioned, to Esquire. I've always been interested in entertainment and the entertainment business, and also in technology. And most of my career has been spent, sort of bouncing around among, various, parts of these different subjects. And when I went to Wired, it kind of all came together in a sense. And what I've done now with The Art of Immersion is essentially a book about how the internet is changing storytelling, how technology is changing the way that we tell stories, that we that stories are told to us, and that we engage with them.
So, I mean, are you talking in that book about the nature of the involvement of the consumer in kind of creating interactivity in the story? I think this came up recently with something you may have heard of, where someone's laptop was stolen, and it was followed and kind of participated in by people on Twitter that ended up getting him back his laptop and getting the thief arrested, and it all took place on Twitter as a kind of live drama, but then has been made into a Storify piece. So you've got this kind of interesting change in the way story is told. The participants are part of the story and are also telling the story. Listeners or viewers are vicariously participating and also part of the action. It's sort of similar to what happens with, kind of the cell phone cameras, which bring action into the lives of people on the internet in ways that are kind of impossible in any other way, but it creates a vicariousness at the same time as a sense of participation.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the combination of Twitter and Storify is really pretty remarkable. And, that's just a wonderful example that you cited. I think, though, that although technology and more importantly, the uses to which technology is being put, like Twitter, they're changing, who tells stories. They're really making it possible for, anyone to, reach a much larger audience, and even, as you suggest, in this case, for a kind of group storytelling to emerge. But at the same time, there's really no lessening of interest in what might be viewed as conventional authored stories, professionally authored stories, whether they're movies, television shows, novels, nonfiction books, any number of things. But what's happening is that they're becoming much less conventional, and they're becoming, you know, in some way participatory. The internet makes it possible for people to, you know, to leap in any number of different ways. And it also makes it possible for people to immerse themselves in whatever story they are, you know, they find really fascinating.
Do you think it's, I mean, of course, this is unclear probably, but do you think it's changing the nature of narrative, or does narrative, because it's such a human kind of psychological and social construct, remain, that, you know, the arc of story stays in place or is retained, but the nature of the telling is what changes?
I think that's you know, pretty accurate. I think the whole idea of a story arc is you know, pretty deeply imprinted on us. But you know, whenever there's a new form of communications technology, it changes the way stories are told. And you know, typically it takes at least 20 or 30 years for people to figure out what to do with it. I mean, the motion picture camera was invented around 1890. And it was 1910 before they even came up with the idea of movie stars. And, you know, and it was about 1915 or so before they really consolidated what, you know, we know now as the grammar of cinema, you know, all these techniques that we take completely for granted, like cuts and pans and fades and close-ups. You know, each of those had to be invented. And it wasn't clear at first that those were going to work, that, you know, that people would understand what a cut meant, for example, and or, you know, cross-cutting from one character to another, one point of view to another. And, you know, something similar is happening now. But, you know, the nature of the Internet, you know, there are a couple of things, a couple of very salient points. One, of course, you know, inherently participatory. It's, you know, really hard not to, you know, kind of jump in and be involved in it. And the other, as I mentioned, you know, very immersive. And, you know, at the same time, you know, just possible to, possible to, you know, leap in and, you know, in a way that, you know, really wasn't possible before. I mean, a good example, I think, is the TV show Lost, which, you know, is really a show that would not have been possible before the Internet. It was deliberately obscure. It was, you know, made in a way that raised more questions than it answered, which is just the antithesis of traditional television. And it almost assumed, and it certainly encouraged people to, you know, get together online just to figure out what was going on. This was not something that could ever have been done before.
So do you think, do you think that applies to books? Do you think that publishing has similar correlate or that there are correlations, that there are ways of making a book participate? I mean, I think there obviously are, but I wonder if you've got some examples of participatory storytelling or a book which makes use of the Internet to enhance the story in specific ways.
You know, I think that's really just beginning to happen, and I think I think the you know, I mean, there are certainly online communities around very popular authors, and in that sense, it sort of, you know, in some ways resembles Lost or the phenomena that happened around Lost. But, you know, with the iPad and other, you know, tablet sorts of technologies, it's really possible to, you know, publish a book in an extremely innovative way. I mean, the other thing about the Internet that I wanted to say is that it's really all media. You know, it's not, you know, it can be text, it can be sound, it can be, you know, video, it can be any combination of the above, you know, obviously graphics and so forth. And of course it's dynamic. So it makes possible an entirely different kind of book than could ever be imagined before. And, you know, I mean, I've just seen that there's a remarkable book by Al Gore called Our Choice, which has just been published in an iPad version, and I believe is number one on the book section of the iPad App Store right now. And the things you can do with it are just extraordinary. Just it's gorgeously rendered, and you touch it, and something new opens up all the time. So I think with books especially, much of the innovation lies ahead of us.
Yeah, I think it's, I know it, I've compared publishing in the electronic or digital space as similar to television in 1947. You know, that, and maybe
right.
similar to what you just talked about in film, that, technological innovation went much slower then because of just the way time was working, and that internet has speeded time up so much that probably book publishing in digital form will go through much faster cycles of innovation, and then you still have to wait for people who read to respond and tell you which things work and which things they respond to and make sense to them. Or you watch how people behave around a particular book and our community and see whether that gives you ideas for how you might adapt the social and digital behaviors to book either writing or publishing. Because it actually could be. Books can be written and created with participatory immersion in mind, or they could be published in that way. In other words, the writer might start with a vision, or the publisher might start with that vision taking off from something that's already written. But it's really, it is difficult to reinvent storytelling in a medium like this. It's really complicated.
Right. Yeah. Yes, it certainly is. I mean, I think one thing that you're happening, that you see happening with nonfiction books in particular, is authors, whether it's in their blogs or any number of other ways, are constantly sort of tossing out trial balloons, tossing out ideas, inviting people to discuss them, and getting feedback, before the actual publication. In many cases, long before the actual publication, and so therefore, the reactions they get, the leads that come up as a result, all of this is interwoven into the finished product. And of course, the other thing is that the finished product is no longer ever quite so finished anymore. I mean, it's hard to find an author who isn't tempted to, tinker with things up until the very last minute. And, fortunately or unfortunately, this makes it possible to keep tinkering after the last minute.
Right, and will drive librarians and people who are trying to archive history absolutely insane, because there, if you think about books as a model, you can track editions, and the changes from one edition to the next are hard enough to deal with. But since digital publishing enables more or less a free-flowing process of change, if I write a book today and I publish it online and I find something in it that I don't like, it's very easy for me to upload a new file, and it's impossible for someone to know that I did that. In many respects. So it's, you could literally rewrite your book every day and upload it as a new file every day, and each reader who bought it each day would find a new book in some measure. And that's just crazy for people who think in terms of structured knowledge and history and trying to figure out versions and version control. It just will make, it creates an incredible mess of chaos, if you, in a certain way, which could be beautiful if you're an artist or a writer.
Right.
That chaos is actually really attractive. Mm. If you're a, an archivist, that chaos will make you want to kill somebody.
Right.
But so I think we could probably talk about the internet forever, but I think what I wanted to, one of the things I wanted to talk about was your experience now in publishing, because this book, West of Eden: The End of Innocence at Apple Computer, which I think you told me was published in 1989 originally, by Viking, and was out of print, I think, for a period of time. You republished a couple of years ago, specifically on Amazon, correct?
On Amazon, because I figured, frankly, that was the best way to ensure that it had really good distribution, especially for the audience that's going to be attracted to a book about Apple, which is I think a large percentage of them, a very large percentage of them, are going to be ebook readers. And what happened with the original book, it was published by Viking and very well published. My editor was Amanda Vail, and I loved working with her. But then eventually, as these things do, the book went out of print, and it sort of lay fallow for a very long time. It was available on Google Books, so you could once that started up, you could find it and read it. But a couple of years ago, I really got to the point where I wanted to claim it again, so to speak. And I had just begun work on this book, on The Art of Immersion, and suddenly I realized, I mean, first off, Steve Jobs was very much in the news. It was when he first took a medical leave from Apple, and it was hard for anybody to imagine Apple without Jobs. And of course, I had written this book. The whole point of West of Eden was it was a 3-year history of Apple in the mid '80s that began with Jobs luring John Sculley to Cupertino to be president of the company, and ended 3 years later with Sculley firing him and Jobs, going off into the wilderness, so to speak, to start Next. And so I realized that there was literally an entire generation of people for whom the idea of Apple without Jobs was more or less unthinkable, and who perhaps vaguely were aware of the thing that had happened back in the ancient past, but would find the story of it really quite freshly interesting. So I talked to my agent about this, and he said, and I'm sure he's quite right, that I could go to a conventional publisher. I could he could send it around. He could try to resell it, and I'm sure there would be some interest. But two things: first off, they would want me to update it. They would want me to really bring it up to date, which wasn't exactly the point. The point was, this is a self-contained story, a story that had relevance to the present day, but you wouldn't it wasn't going to be a 25-year history of Apple. And at the same time, he said, well, even if we do this, they're not going to publish it for a year. And I thought, a year? This is ridiculous. So I went to Amazon. Worked with a friend who's a graphic designer. I relicensed the original cover art. I wrote an introduction, maybe 3,000 words or so, to kind of bring it up to date, really just to connect the dots between here and between now and then. And 2 months after I had the idea, it was up on Amazon, and both in paperback and in Kindle form. So I think that was that was what I thought ought to be done with that book. There was no point in turning it into a whole new book, certainly, and there was no point in waiting a year to do it.
Well, so just on a technical level, did you work with your which file did you use to reprint the book or and to upload to Kindle? Was it the did you have to get the file? Well, there probably wasn't a file, a digital file from the original book, because it was done in 1989. Did you have to, so did you scan it or did you retype it or?
Well, I mean, it might as well have been done in 1889, frankly. The way that Amazon works with these things is they will scan it for you, and so you have it looks exactly like the original book in terms of the layout, the design, the pages, everything. And I had copies that were in very good condition, and frankly, been in a box and never come out for all that time. And one thing that I did was I also licensed the typeface that had been used in the original, and I just used that myself to set the type for the parts that I added. And then, as I said, I worked with a designer to take the original cover art, which I always thought was brilliant, and do a new type and new back cover and everything for it. So, really, all I had to do was turn in, was send in a couple of copies of the book, turn in PDFs of the cover and the back cover and the material that I wanted to add, and that was that.
So, and I, as I understand it, the book has done fairly well. Now, are you selling, like, in terms of the sales numbers, is the Kindle edition selling well compared to the paperback? Which one is doing better?
I think the Kindle is doing better. I'm not, I frankly I haven't, paid terribly close attention to these matters, but they've both been selling, I think, reasonably well for, certainly for a book that's at this point more than 20 years old. And when I first brought them out, I wrote about it. I actually sort of, did a little excerpt from on Wired.com, which got a fair amount of attention, among people who are, interested in Apple in particular. So it did quite well out of the gate, so to speak, and continues to sell now. So, I mean, one of the things, with print on demand and with eBooks, there's really no reason that a book can't be kept in print indefinitely.
Right. No, that I think is a clear advantage, and I think more and more authors themselves are feeling that they're out of print books. They want them back in print, and some know less than you do, let's say, about the technology, or don't have access to graphic artists. So, I talk often to authors who need help doing it, but basically, it isn't that difficult to do. And for many writers, the goal is not so much the drive to remonetize their backlist. It's just because they want their babies back in print. And
Exactly.
this and of course Amazon primarily enables that. Obviously, there are other methods you can use to make it available in all, in a wider range of venues, but it's more complicated and probably requires more effort than a lot of writers themselves want to do. So what else have you done in terms of marketing the book? Or is it just you basically have let it find its way?
More or less, I've let it find its way. I didn't feel that I had an immense amount of time to devote to it. I did set up a website for it, so that people could find it easily. It's not that I'm trying to drive traffic to the website, but more of just a resource for people who might want to learn more about it. And one thing that Amazon does, which is quite helpful, is they make it possible to create an author page and to sort of curate your own author page so that all of your books, both the in-print ones and the ones that are out of print, are sort of accessible at the same spot. And there's You can have an author photo. You can do sort of anything. You can link your blog to it and your Twitter feed, which both of which I've done. It's just, I think it's called Author Central, and that's exactly the function it serves. It's just sort of a central place where you can make everything available and readily accessible. And aside from the excerpt that I did in Wired.com, that was really kind of the extent of my marketing efforts. I essentially just wanted to make it known and make it available to people who were really interested in Apple.
Have you, and I'm actually on your Author Central page, which is pretty nice, because it is true, you can find out a lot more about you right there. Have you heard from readers or other, people in the business, anybody, have you kind of gotten any feedback back on the present, the republication of West of Eden, people who have discovered it anew, I assume, after 20 years, people who are finding it now probably never knew about it, in that earlier time.
Right, indeed. I've gotten kind of informal feedback. I've run into people when I've been giving talks about the new book who also know about this one. Which is frankly one of the reasons I wanted to do it. It had come out so long ago I felt that it was something I wanted people to identify with me and also to identify with the new book, because I felt there would be a certain, sort of crossover, readership or at least interest in the subject. It's gotten a fair amount of comments on Amazon.com, on its own Amazon page. So, that's been very gratifying feedback as well. Most of my focus in terms of what I'm writing about myself or what I'm speaking about has been on the new book. I just wanted this to be available as sort of background and not kind of like some dusty tome hidden in the corner.
So, and have you heard from any other writers? I mean, I'm curious about that because I know many writers talk to their colleagues essentially, and you share concerns and complaints and but also suggestions for things that you can do. Obviously, if you know other writers, they have backlist titles too. Have you talked to any of them who now know that you did this book, West of Eden? Do they say, well, show me how I could do this myself?
Yeah, I know. Certainly, I've had a couple of those conversations, and it's very interesting. It is, as you say, really quite easy to do. It's not that complicated, and it requires a small outlay of money, but really not very much. I did all of this, including licensing the cover art, for under $1,000, certainly. Has been worth it, not just monetarily, but in terms of the benefit I've gotten from it. I do think that this is a really extremely viable option. I'm extremely pleased with the way it turned out. I will say, by the same token, that I would not have wanted to publish this myself if it were an original book. When it came out 20 years ago, was I thrilled with everything that was done with it? Not necessarily, but in general, I was treated quite well, and I think especially at that time, it was much much harder to do something like this. But also, I feel that authors need feedback from their editors, and it's a very rare author who doesn't need it. And, you know, I think if there's one thing that's kind of, you know, where the publishing industry falls down, it's that, you know, many authors don't get as much feedback as they need.
Well, that's, you know, I think that's clearly true, although I, you know, I obviously times have changed too. I was going to ask you, you know, what you thought about the possibility of this kind of, you know, I don't even want to call it self-publishing. I think that there are, you know, it sort of diminishes, you know, that's become a kind of misnomer for what a kind of range of publishing is, you know, because the implication is if you have to publish it yourself, there's got to be something wrong with it or something wrong with you because the market won't support you. And I think it's actually the other way around, that the market is what has a problem and not, I mean, of course, there are plenty of books self-published or published in some form generated by the author that may lack that essential editorial feedback that you're talking about. But of course, you know, an author could today hire editors,
sure.
You know, and as you hired a graphic designer, you know, that if, and if then you had, then the challenge is in the sort of power dynamic, you know, when a publisher is paying for everything, they have a certain amount of authority that they can say to an author, I need you to change the book. And the author might not feel the same way, but, you know, the publisher is paying for it, and they kind of have a certain, and they have this, the knowledge of the market and, you know, potentially this kind of broader sphere of information, let's say, than an individual author might. But when the author is paying the editor, maybe the editor is not so willing to say to the author, you need to change this, or this is a bad, you know, this is a really bad chapter, you better drop it. You know, it's sort of an interesting dynamic to look at. But I'm just wondering that, you know, whether, you know, you might be tempted in the future, certainly I know a lot of other authors are, where they have a book, they look at it and say, you know, 2 years, to wait 2 years to publish the book is not practical. And, you know, publishing digitally, publishing in digital short run is so much quicker, as you just, you know, as you just did. Even if you added in the editorial cycle and, you know, the copy editing and proofreading that you have to do with a new book, you know, it is much more work to do a new book than it is to do a reprint. It still seems like that's going to be increasingly plausible for authors. Or for other forms of entities working with authors that take on some of the role of publisher but short circuit the time frame.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's, you know, I mean, that certainly makes sense. I think that you know, what really has to happen though is that, you know, that publishers need to, you know, sort of reorient themselves to, you know, these kinds of new realities. I mean, I think that a couple of things, you know, it's certainly great that authors have the option now of publishing something of themselves or of overseeing the publication of it themselves. And there are many cases, you know, including a couple of my own, where, you know, marketing and, you know, editorial advice is, you know, from your publisher, or, you know, not necessarily always advice, you know, but direction is, you know, either not particularly good or, you know, more likely, you know, just inadequate. And then there are other cases, you know, where it's really the, you know, marketing is the problem. In fact, I'd say that's much more often the problem with publishers. You know, I've had a couple of cases where, you know, and West of Eden was not one of them, by the way, where, you know, titles were changed, you know, and the advice of like some marketing people who I would say did not really have a clue what they were talking about. And, you know, you'd always run up against that possibility when you are dealing with, you know, somebody else, and when you allow them to have, you know, some measure of control. On the other hand, you know, if you, you know, try to do it all yourself, There's the at least equally likely possibility that that you're the one who's out of control, and that I don't think there's any automatic answer to these things. I think it really depends on a case by case basis. With Norton on my new book, I was very lucky to deal with a terrific editor, Brendan Curry, who gave me great feedback, and a terrific production team that number one ensured that it got a really good cover and consulted with me. Believe me, went through any number of iterations to get to the one that we have now, and at the same time, also realized that this was a book that, would not benefit from a very long production cycle, to say the least. And so, they put it essentially on a crash schedule, which means that, about 6 months after I turned it in, it was on the shelves. And that's a very short time when you consider, we spent 2 months going through copy editing, and, I hired a fact checker. My editor weighed in. There was a great deal of work to be done after I, turned in the draft. And, we had a finished manuscript, I think, at the end of November, and by mid-January we had finished books back, and by early February they were on sale.
Yeah, that's pretty good, actually. That's a very short schedule,
and
kind of belies the the traditional complaint about the length of time that it takes a publisher to get a book to market.
Yeah.
I think that's all good. I also think it's possible that, and I wanted to ask you about this, that especially since you're a journalist, that online or digital publishing is now beginning to enable a kind of redefinition of what we define as a published object, whether we call it a book or something else, with apps like the Atavist or the site like Byliner, the idea that you can take a piece of writing and make it available because digital publishing enables it. If it's 10,000 words, that's not a book, but it's still something that people might want to read and that they might want to pay for. And I think that's kind of an interesting new wrinkle that has lots of potential. It kind of harkens back to the way we started the conversation with the idea of immersion and the web and kind of the new connections that it creates, where story and maybe especially nonfiction, well, short story, memoir, nonfiction that is in shorter form, there's a lot more possibility there for an actual publishing business to emerge that doesn't need to worry about the length.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's definitely the case. I mean, I see many analogies here to the music business, and ever since the demise of the CD, artists continue to including very sort of trendy bands from Williamsburg and so forth, continue to produce album length work, but they also do much shorter things. EPs are much more common. You can do any number of things, from simply posting them to the web to making finished products that can be available for download or sale as CD or vinyl or most commonly all three, and I think that the real impact, well, a couple of things about the emergence of the iPad and other tablets like that, it makes it possible to imagine something, a piece of writing as an object, at least a temporarily finished object, unlike, when something is simply up on the web, it seems, kind of endlessly expandable or contractible. When it's available as an app, it has a much more finished quality about it. And I think each of those is valuable in different stages of the work. I have a blog and I get a lot of benefit from it. I love kind of, working things out in blog form. But I also like, having a more finished version that is still subject to revision, but not quite in such an open-ended way.
No, I think that makes sense. I think that's what we're seeing is a kind of the ability for many different forms and formats to coexist, and a kind of new iteration of the ecosystem of publishing. And I think the music and even film comparisons are very apt. I think each media form has different issues, and there may be things that vary, but I think the internet or the web has had similar effects on the containerization of products and the kind of in the way that forms and formats can be redefined, not based on the commercial requirement of what it takes to physically print and distribute a book or what it takes to physically press and distribute a CD. Mm-hmm. That is kind of, I mean, that's great fun. It's really disruptive. It's kind of been difficult for a lot of traditional businesses, but I think for the artists and the writers and the readers, it makes for a really exciting time.
Right, indeed.
So, well, thanks so much, Frank. It was really great talking to you. This is David Wilk for Publishing Talks. I've been talking to Frank Rose. He's the author of, most recently, The Art of Immersion, How the Digital Generation is Remaking Hollywood, Madison Avenue, and The Way We Tell Stories, which I think is a really interesting book, as well as the recently self-republished book, The West of Eden. Thanks so much for talking to me, Frank.
Thanks, David.